Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the more I'm hearing about this secret, or this hearing behind closed doors with the former acting attorney general who laid it out. You know, I mean, what we're finding out is there was a coup attempt. Donald Trump was behind it. He attempted to overthrow our elections and had everything in place. And what's scary to me, and this is the weird part, is that a good portion of the country okay with it. And it reminded me going back to, you know, when I was a kid, I had some friends whose grandparents had come from the old country. They were Germans from the old country. And, you know, when you asked them, how could that happen? How could you? They just said it just did. And people came along and it was a creeping thing. It didn't happen overnight. It was a process. Are we in the middle of that process? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, could we see that kind of insanity here? Or are we living through it now? I've asked Harvey Kay to come talk with us. Harvey's an author and professor of democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. His books, Tom Paine and the Promise of America, The Fight for Four Freedoms, Take Hold of Our History, and FDR on Democracy, all available at Powell's Books. Harvey, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure. Always great to talk to you, Rick. Always.
So, you know, I think back to some of the people that I've known years ago who, you know, they grew up during the years of the rise of the Third Reich and the rise of, you know, fascism. And, you know, they never had an answer of how it happened. I'm looking at what's going on now and I'm questioning, are we living through the potential of something like that? Because I know people were perfectly okay with Trump getting away with attempting to overthrow our election.
Well, it struck me even on the day leading up to that day of January 6th, that something clearly was in the making. And look, I mean, whether we call Trump a wannabe fascist, a wannabe Mussolini, a wannabe Juan Perón, whatever it is, his commitment to democracy was not just limited. He was from the beginning, he revealed his antithetical views. I mean, think about the fact of who he embraced in foreign policy, right? Erdogan in Turkey, Duarte, is that how you pronounce it? Duarte in the Philippines. I mean, if you were a dictator of a country that he might otherwise use the S word to describe, and he embraced you, not to mention his eagerness to spend time with
Kim Jong-un, and the love letters, the love letters they wrote each other.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, what were we to make of that? And I haven't even mentioned the P word, Putin, right? I mean, he probably admired Putin's capacity to sustain himself in power and do so by making sure the Russians were in some fashion cowed or, you know, basically marginal to any kind of real public discourse. And he knocked off opponents. Now, one thing everyone should appreciate is this. The creeping authoritarianism did not begin during the Trump administration. It actually goes back 45 years. All the things that you and I talked about for years regarding the effort to smash labor unions, to reduce the legacy of the New Deal, whether it had to do with social welfare programs or the rights of workers, the legacy of the Great Society years, the Voting Rights, the Civil Rights Act. I mean, all of these have been under siege for a good 45, maybe even we could say 50 years. And I know that sounds so long that how can I make a theory out of this? Well, the point is, think about it. In the course of all those decades, we saw workers' rights under siege. We saw women's rights under siege. We saw voting rights under siege. And by the way, it isn't only conservatives. I don't want to upset the Democrats who will probably make up most of our audience. But the fact is that it isn't only the Republicans who were involved in that. It was also corporate neoliberal Democrats who rode the wave. And so, at a certain point, you can imagine, you know, inequality is growing. Ever since the early 1970s, the working class hasn't seen a rise in its real wages and living standards. If you add to that the fact that you had these prominent figures stripping workers of rights, let's not forget the USA Patriot Act, okay, only had one no vote, right? And that was the no vote of Russ Feingold from Wisconsin. And I guess it was Daschle, who was the majority leader at the time. He was going after Feingold in the Senate cloakroom, trying to get him to come out and vote in favor of the USA Patriot Act, which, you know, involved investigations of Americans, checking on the books that people were taking out of libraries, a whole host of things. So we've seen this over and over again. And to what extent, look, I mean, the Clinton administration never really consulted Americans on trade acts. They didn't consult Americans on healthcare initiatives. My point is this: decade upon decade upon decade, Americans saw their incomes stagnate, the vast majority of working people. They saw billionaires emerge. I mean, when I was younger, I couldn't even imagine the word billionaire describing someone, okay?
And now we've got 1,000 of them.
Yeah. Wow, pretty good. That's the kind of thing they used to brag about. We have 1,000 billionaires in America. They used to talk about how many millionaires we had in America. So we had all of this anger regarding the state of America and where it was going. I won't deny my candidate two times around was Bernie Sanders, and I think we would have had a different trajectory if he had won. And the fact is that Americans were looking for change, radical change. And there were those who wanted to do it democratically and those who just wanted to see some strong guy come in and slap around the corporate class, slap around the liberals. You know who I'm referring to. They wanted somebody like Donald Trump. Not to mention, he fanned the flames of division in this country. And by the way, let's face it, authoritarianism can thrive when you start dividing the people amongst themselves. When people see each other not as fellow citizens, but in some kind of identity politics that they don't like, then, you know, this was on and on and on. So now what have we got? Well, we have a Biden administration that is struggling to get a major couple of infrastructure plans through, finds itself literally incapable of getting a Voting Rights Act passed, incapable of getting the PRO Act for workers enacted. I mean, we're really confronting a situation which is really ripe for authoritarianism. And in that regard, I'll add one other thing. All of these initiatives around the country, in this instance, by Republicans, who are doing everything in their power to disempower citizens, to make it difficult to vote, to literally make it nearly impossible in some counties to vote. What does this imply? It implies an antipathy to democracy. And what's the alternative to democracy? Authoritarianism. Right?
Yeah, but they got the Karens out there at those school board meetings exercising their democracy because they don't want their kids wearing masks, Harvey.
Oh yeah, the mask. I used to avoid any kind of sort of social psychological analysis of America or any people, but you get to the point where you have to wonder what kind of mental health disease are we all suffering? You know, I want to read you a quote from Franklin Roosevelt in 1938, keeping in mind that fascism was on the rise, both in the East, in East Asia, and decidedly so in Central Europe. Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and the civil war in Spain, which ended up in a phalangist, essentially a fascist victory. And Roosevelt, in 1938, on the eve of the midterm elections, gave a speech on radio, and he said this very interesting paragraph, and I have to read it. As of today, he said, fascism and communism and old line Tory republicanism are not threats to the continuation of our form of government. But I venture the challenging statement that if American democracy ceases to move forward as a living force, seeking day and night by peaceful means to better the lot of our citizens, then fascism and communism, aided unconsciously perhaps by old line Tory republicanism, will grow in strength in our land. Now that's a description of the last few decades of America.
Absolutely.
So, right? So Americans felt that that neither party really had the interests of working people in mind and in their hearts. And we've now gotten to the situation where the Republican Party has become a decidedly, you know, white nationalist in many ways, decidedly antithetical to democracy kind of political party. And the Democrats are not yet unified enough to take advantage of their hold on Congress to make laws, new laws, that would enhance the chances of democracy. We're in trouble, serious trouble. I realize we're better off now than we might have been a couple of years ago under Trump. But seriously, in the face of the pandemic, in the face of how many voted for Trump? 70 million?
Yeah.
Okay, the vast majority of whom, they support the Democratic ideals, the Democratic Party's ideals, but they sure as hell seem to want to bring back, if not Trump, then another Republican who will pursue a similar agenda, maybe a smarter, better, kind of guy. And I mentioned to you a number of times, Josh Hawley.
Yeah, I don't think he's charismatic enough to be able to pick up where Trump left off. I think, like Trump, don't like him. There's a charisma about him. There's a used car salesman kind of instinct about him that he knows what people want and need to hear, and he feeds the red meat. Because look,
but Hawley is better looking than Trump.
Yeah, but I've seen him speak. I'm not impressed.
Okay, good. Because I've only seen him do interviews. I've never seen him give a public address.
Yeah, I'm again, I fear the normalization of what Trump brought us. I fear that kind of, we're okay with overturning elections as long as our side wins. And I'm not in favor of that on either side. But this week, and I wanted to go back to what you said a minute ago about the fact that you've got people who are struggling. The fact of the matter is, in the Economic Policy Institute just came out with this new analysis that said from 1978 to 2020, our CEO class saw their pay rise over 1,300%, while the average working class person barely 18%. And you go right there. We're in this moment where for 40-plus years, you've got people who are stagnant and declining wages and struggling to make ends meet. And nobody in our political class has really tried to help them. And I'm looking at what Biden's trying to do now, and I'm going, it's about time. We need to do something big and make big investments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, there are two things we need if we think about the records of the past. Number one, we definitely need public investment, right? And here's one of my fears. I love telling you my fears. Okay. You're like my therapist.
All right.
I never had a therapist. You'll be my therapist.
I'm okay with that.
Okay. So my fear is this. If you look closely at the bill that just made its way through the Senate, this is the $1 trillion bill, they're calling it.
Right. The bipartisan
for infrastructure.
Bill.
So, the roads and the bridges and so on. The fact is that there were things taken out of Biden administration's original proposal that make this a potentially a major gift to the big telecom companies. Let me give you an example of what I mean. So back in the 1930s, when Roosevelt and the Democrats and the New Deals were pursuing the initiatives of the New Deal, among the most significant initiatives was the Rural Electrification Agency. And what they did is they said, look, throughout the South and good parts of the country, power companies are unwilling to provide electric lines and electric power to farmers.
Right.
Okay. These in the rural areas were being neglected. Why were they unwilling? Because they didn't think it would be profitable enough. So the Roosevelt administration launched the Rural Electrification Agency to encourage and to help create cooperatives. They created 400 electric cooperatives around the country. Several hundred thousand farmers for the first time ever had electric power in their homes and barns. Okay, it was incredible. Now, what have we got this time? This major infrastructure plan, which is supposed to provide broadband access for rural citizens in rural areas, is not going to be pursued as a public initiative. It will be pursued through contracts, through grants that will then be issued, I believe, by states to companies. What they did is the companies lobbied so effectively, they removed from the bill that made its way through the Senate the possibility of cooperatives and municipalities themselves undertaking these initiatives. And I can tell you, in these many years, I think it's as many as two dozen states had passed laws forbidding such initiatives. This act would have lifted those laws in favor of allowing cooperatives and municipalities to take charge of the broadband access. So what's going to happen? Well, maybe Comcast, Spectrum, and a whole host of other corporations already have monopoly control in so many areas. They'll be given huge sums of money to pursue this, and there'll be no competition when it comes to that kind of access. I mean, that's just a worry I have.
Right.
And what I'm getting at is when the trucks go in to do the work, they'll have the corporate names on the side, and it won't say, "This is your government at work," but rather, "This is Comcast or someone else." And Americans will not get the feeling that government can be empowering, that government is a good and not necessarily an imposition. That's one of my fears.
No, it's an excellent point. And it's like anything, the devil in the details and how this rolls out. Now, we do desperately need broadband access in rural communities.
Absolutely.
And, we desperately need that kind of investment.
Right, which is why it would be hard to deny the importance of this bill. It's just the tragedy is the corporate lobbyists just get their hands on these things. And, you know, the Biden administration was supposed to be the new Brandeis moment. Okay, the appointment of an assistant attorney general, was it Josh, I blanked out his name, Kattner, is it? And then over in the Federal Trade Commission, it's Lena Khan. They were supposed, they're the ones who didn't believe there ought to be this kind of corporate monopoly over so many sectors of our economy. But meanwhile, the bill that's going through, it's as if those folks had no say in the making of it.
It's something that, there's something we should be lobbying for, don't you think?
Yes. Citizens lobbying. That's right. And there are folks who've been trying to do that. But it's, you know, we're up against incredible power. If we have 1,000 billionaires, and how many, think about Amazon and think about Google and think about these corporations that they've literally at one and the same time become powerhouses in the economy and literally dominant forces in civil society, because so much conversation, for example, takes place by way of Facebook and Twitter and so on. Is that a public space or is it a private space? That's the old question of democracy. Are you going to have a civil society, or is it going to be a corporate dominated or state dominated civil society?
Well, I mean, if you look at the definition of fascism, you know, it's the bundling of sticks. It's the bringing together of corporate and government interests. The trains run on time. There's profit to be made.
Wait a second. We don't even have trains to run on time in this country.
Probably a bad analogy for that. You're right. But this,
did I hear laughter in the background there?
After this, maybe we get that. Maybe that happens. But I do want to come back for a minute because you brought up Josh Hawley's name a moment ago. There's this this Love America Act or whatever it is that he's promoted.
Yeah. Right.
That you know is basically saying that we have to teach our kids to recite, you know, certain things. I think it's the Pledge of Allegiance in first grade, the Constitution in fourth grade, the preamble in fourth grade. By eighth grade, read the Declaration of Independence and recite the preamble. And 10th grade, identify the Bill of Rights. Why is that a bad idea? I mean, on its face, I'm looking at it and I'm going, it's all stuff that I learned.
Not a bad idea at all, though it's hard for me to believe fourth graders can make their way through the U.S. Constitution. But that's a pedagogical question. It's not a bad idea at all. I actually think it's great. And here's another example where the conservatives are out ahead of the progressives on these kinds of things. But then if you read the next element in it, is that any school that links these documents to some kind of history of racism in America will lose its federal funding. That's the punchline of the act, right? So what he's, and by the way, somebody said to me today, well, what about special education schools? What about schools where it would be impossible to accomplish those kinds of things? I mean, are they going to be included or excluded? This is a simple act that's literally, this is an act in its own way of educational authoritarianism.
Right. But this, okay, what this for me does is, and you're right, the next part of the act says would make schools ineligible for federal funding if they teach that the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, or Pledge of Allegiance are the product of white supremacy or racism. So this is the boogeyman right now. It's that critical thinking thing. We don't want to talk about the history of this country. And look, I want my kids taught actual history, not some idealized version of it, not some made up fantasy, actual history.
Yes. And the day right now, the divide in that debate is a tragic one. Okay. But goes along with the politics of our time. So the Republicans see, the conservatives see any kind of discussion of the American story that relates the stories of exploitation and oppression, of racism, of the marginalization of women. These things are somehow going to destroy any sense of patriotism. On the other hand, and I do not subscribe to the 1619 Project. Okay, I just don't. But there is no way you can tell the American story honestly without talking about slavery,
right?
Without talking about racism, without talking about, for that matter, the antagonism towards immigrants, despite the fact that we claim to be this nation of immigrants. I mean, those things must be included, but fundamentally, what we should never forget is that the American story is a story of struggle, and that in fact we have transcended slavery, we transcended peonage, and it isn't that we all did it together. It took struggles from the bottom up. I love the, what is it? Langston Hughes poem. I that should be taught in schools, right? You know that poem, Let America Be America Again?
Right.
Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. But then the punchline really to the whole thing is let America be America again. Let it be the land that has yet to be. I mean, that's the story of those struggles. I every year I was teaching historical perspectives on American democracy. First thing I did is I had my students read that poem and make sense of it.
But you know, this is the thing that gets me. A lot of people go, well, why do you have a problem with this? And you know, because none of the things on there that I have a problem with, until you get to the other part of it, the punchline, as you said.
Yeah.
Now you're going to try and narrow the focus of what education actually is, which is critical thinking and understanding history and contextualizing it. And they're trying to continue to sell this narrative that is quite frankly, I think, dangerous.
Yeah, but that's why I said to you, Josh Hawley, keep an eye on him.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see. As always, good stuff, Harvey. I appreciate the time. Good conversation. But I'm hoping the Love America Act doesn't pass. If you take that other part out of it, I'd sign on to it. But we'll see where that goes.
I agree with you. So would I.
Just like they did you see the Tuberville thing? Tommy Tuberville came out with this. We're talking about how the Democrats want to defund the police, and you know how he's got a bill that's going to make sure that we fund the police. And then Cory Booker jumped up and said, thank you for bringing this up, because we don't want to defund the police. And they voted like 99-0 to move Tuberville's piece of legislation. So the gotcha moment he was hoping for ended up, well, not being a gotcha moment.
I don't know whether or not our story these days is tragedy, irony, or comedy.
It's all of the above. That simple. Harvey, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Good stuff. Harvey K., professor of democracy there at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Make sure you check out the books, Thomas Paine and The Promise of America, Fight for Four Freedoms. Also, Take Hold of Our History and FDR on Democracy. You can get all those over at Powell's Books. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.